I think Republicans know we need a credible conservative candidate to take on Mark Begich. We know that we need unity to be able to win.
Another Republican enters the race to unseat Senator Begich. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 18th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, convincing rural kids to consider law enforcement careers.
We need folks from this region to be the next generation of public safety employees.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. Complete a bachelor program without leaving home. Whether a first-time or transfer student, the University of Alaska Southeast has the degree for you. Visit ketch.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell is running for U.S. Senate. He announced early today he will not seek re-election and instead will try to win the GOP nomination to take on Senator Mark Begich. APRN's Peter Granitz reports.
Treadwell says he's getting into the race because he knows he can win. He would not do it half-heartedly. His statement mentions neither Begich nor the GOP primary, and if he wants to face Begich, he'll need to survive what is sure to be a hard nominating contest. He took a swipe at fellow Republican candidate Joe Miller without naming him.
I think Republicans know we need a credible conservative candidate to take on Mark Begich. We know that we need unity to be able to win.
Unity, something lacking in the 2010 Senate race. Miller, then a political neophyte, stormed onto the scene and upset incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski in the primary. She went on to win the general election in a write-in campaign. Murkowski says she urged Treadwell to run, but out of principle, will remain neutral during the primary.
The best thing to do is steer clear of it. I learned that from my father, who didn't endorse me in my very first race for the Alaska State Legislature because I was in a contested primary. It was good advice.
She calls Treadwell the front runner. Miller says he welcomes Treadwell's announcement that competition is good for the party.
I'm an anti-establishment candidate.
He says Alaska voters will have a clear distinction in the primary, but he says he does not want to highlight the differences between he and Treadwell right now. That will come during the race.
I would consider at least all of the names I've heard that are contemplating getting into this race as establishment-type candidates.
Many observers in Washington see Treadwell as the establishment candidate, too. He'll be here next week, meeting with party leaders, including the National Republican Senatorial Committee. That group, officially tasked with regaining control of the Senate, refuses to discuss Miller's candidacy. It would like to avoid another nasty primary, which does not take place until August 2014. The group has said Begich's seat is crucial to winning control of the upper chamber. That's something Treadwell is keenly aware of.
If you can put the Republicans back in the leadership, you would make Lisa Murkowski head of the Senate Energy Committee. That's going to help us with ANWR. That's going to help us with access to our lands. And I think that's the defining issue.
It's hard to see a difference between Begich and Treadwell on the major issue in the state. Both support expanded oil and gas drilling. Treadwell promises to campaign on three causes: fighting for liberty, fighting for fiscal sanity, and fighting for Alaska. He invokes a sacred name when he talks of his campaign, former Senator Ted Stevens. He says he'll follow in the Stevens tradition of bringing power back to Alaska, letting Alaskans make decisions about the state, not the federal government.
That part of his legacy of trying to bring the decision-making home is the legacy that I want to work on. We've got a federal system now where we are spending too much, we're borrowing too much, we're taxing too much, and asking the federal government for earmarks is probably not the right way to go.
Of course, Stevens is most remembered as the chair of the Appropriations Committee, who doled out government money in projects all over Alaska. Jennifer Duffy is senior editor with the Cook Political Report, a nonpartisan political newsletter. She says even though it's early, this does not look like it will be as monumental a primary as 2010.
You don't see the Tea Party groups rallying around Miller like they did in 2010. The other thing is, I have not heard of any of these groups having a real problem with Treadwell.
Those groups don't have any issues with Governor Sean Parnell either, and Duffy says that helps Treadwell. And this far off, there's still plenty of time for others to hop in the race too. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski's version of the Sea Alaska Lands Bill has passed out of its only committee of referral. That's a major step toward a Senate floor vote, but there's no guarantee it will move any further in Congress. Its best chance is as part of a package of lands legislation. Murkowski told the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee today that it's the result of years of negotiations.
And I recognize that it has created tensions within our communities, but we have worked aggressively and tirelessly with all of the stakeholders, not just Sea Alaska and their shareholders.
The bill is co-sponsored by Alaska Senator Mark Begich. A similar measure by Alaska Representative Don Young passed out of the House Natural Resources Committee last week. The Southeast Alaska Conservation Council has endorsed the legislation as a reasonable compromise. But other critics, including environmental, sportsmen, and small community groups, continue to oppose the bill. The bill would allow the regional native corporation to choose about 68,000 acres of timberland from within the Tongass National Forest. Supporters of various initiatives are out in full force collecting signatures with the purpose of getting on next year's ballot. Those signatures become part of the public record, and anyone can access these lists. A Republican senator from Fairbanks wants that to change, but some activists are worried his proposal could have unintended consequences. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
The legislative session is months away, but already Senator Pete Kelly's office is drafting a bill that would make the signatures collected during the initiative process confidential. He sees it as a matter of urgency.
We're just kind of living in an odd environment right now where I believe people are pretty nervous about what happens to their names or how they get on lists. So one thing we can do is the state, I don't think the state should be able to sell those names, and those lists should be fairly private.
Right now, there are a lot of petitions floating about. There's one to legalize marijuana and another to recall Anchorage Republican Lindsey Holmes from the legislature for switching parties. There are also propositions that would repeal a tax cut for oil companies and make it harder to develop Pebble Mine, both issues where Kelly has taken a pro-development stance. His office is now warning Alaskans that they should be very concerned about giving their names to strangers with clipboards. Kelly thinks his announcement is timely because of the number of petitions currently circulating and because discussion about data sharing is now happening at a national level. The motivation came
mostly just from conversations about the NSA thing. And then somebody mentioned to me that the initiative gatherers names are sold, and I just kind of Those two events kind of crossed in my mind, and I thought, well, that isn't a very good idea.
But some are wondering if there might be other reasons for bringing up his proposal now, so far ahead of the legislative session. Pat Lavin is one of the organizers of the referendum to repeal the oil tax cut. He describes the announcement as a sort of black helicopter message that could make it harder to gather the 30,000 signatures needed to get on the ballot.
I hear a message designed to make people think twice about signing a petition.
Kelly's office says that's not their intent. According to his staff, they're not trying to discourage anyone from signing any petition. They just want people to know that their names are available upon request. Meanwhile, government transparency advocates have some reservations about the actual substance of the proposal.
We think this legislation is not a great idea.
That's Joshua Decker with the ACLU of Alaska. He gets why people might bristle at the idea of political operatives or even telemarketers buying their names and addresses. But he says the consequences of making these signatures confidential would be even more serious. If there isn't open access to these lists, there's no way for the public to verify if a petition got the necessary signatures to appear on the ballot. Decker also says that the concern that some people aren't having their voice heard because they're worried about privacy is overblown.
We as an organization are not aware of anyone who said, but for the fact that my signature would be confidential, I am not going to sign on this particular ballot initiative.
Kelly's staff says they're open to hearing about any concerns about transparency or how their legislation would affect signature gatherers as they're drafting the bill. They have 6 months until they introduce it formally in January. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, another attempt to change the name of North America's highest peak.
It deserves to be called the name that the Athabascans from the interior have called it for decades and decades and decades.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A wildfire east of Fairbanks is drawing a massive air and ground response. The Canuti Fire started in a neighborhood off China Hot Springs Road near Mile 17. State Division of Forestry spokeswoman Maggie Rogers says things are going well.
We continue to have no evacuations. We continue to have no structures lost. And the fire is an estimated 120 acres. It's not contained, but they're going to be working on that today.
China Hot Springs Road is open, but Rogers warns there could be traffic delays depending on fire and suppression activities, which are occurring on both sides of the road. Rogers says the Canuti Fire is human caused, but could not provide details as an investigation is underway. She says numerous wildfires are being responded to as hot, dry, windy conditions persist. Red flag warnings for extreme fire danger are in effect for much of the state south of the Brooks Range, and Rogers encourages Alaskans to be ready.
Creating defensible space around their home, it's important that people rehearse evacuation plans with family members. People with dog teams and horses and other things like that, it's always good to not only plan for your family, but plan for your pets as well.
Rogers also recommends clearly marking your home's address, identifying any alternative routes out of your neighborhood, and having non-local phone contacts who can relay fire information if the power goes out. Fairbanks Natural Gas has released details of a North Slope to Fairbanks gas trucking project proposal. The documents lay out costs and components of a system to treat and liquefy gas, including propane, and load it onto tanker trucks for shipment south. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The North Slope portion of the LNG trucking project is predicted to cost $160 million, down from an earlier estimate of $240 million. Following what the company describes as a value engineering process, Fairbanks Natural Gas President Dan Britton says the new design and work plan are more efficient.
Streamlining the operations and making sure that everything was truckable modules and that limiting the amount of work that actually needs to take place on the North Slope.
Britton says reducing storage capacity at the 300,000-gallon per day North Slope LNG plant also helped lower the cost. He says the $160 million is only for North Slope facilities and does not include a $35 million storage facility in Fairbanks or transportation and local distribution piping.
The distribution system is another couple hundred million dollars. The trailers and trucks are about $45 million in total over time.
FNG currently only has a limited local distribution piping network in Fairbanks, serving about 1,100 customers, with plans to expand into high and medium demand areas. The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority is reviewing FNG's proposal and those from other companies interested in the trucking project. Britton says Fairbanks Natural Gas released details of the project proposal it submitted to the state back in January.
To facilitate the project moving forward as quickly as possible, and so that the public could also be as informed as possible as we move forward, hopefully jointly with the state on this project.
Britton says FNG hopes to take full advantage of state low-interest financing, as well as a $57.5 million ADA grant that would make the state an equity partner in the North Slope LNG plant. ADA and the Alaska Energy Authority have been reviewing proposals from all companies interested in gas trucking and expect to release an economic feasibility analysis of the project next month. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
In the wake of several high-profile cases of alleged scale tampering by Bering Sea groundfish vessels, the National Marine Fisheries Service is revising its regulations for weighing fish at sea. As KUCB's Stephanie Joyce reports, the new measures are aimed at making it more difficult for vessels to underreport their catch.
The Bering Sea's large catcher processors weigh their harvest as it heads to the processing line on what's known as a flow scale, a section of conveyor belt that takes dozens of measurements per second. When properly calibrated, flow scales give fisheries managers a very accurate estimate of the amount of fish being harvested. But like all scales, they can be manipulated.
I'm hesitant to lay out exactly how one could tamper with the scale.
That's Alan Kinsolving. He's in charge of at-sea measurement for the National Marine Fisheries Service and helped draft the new regulations. As he explained to the North Pacific Fishery Management Council at its meeting this month, there are lots of ways that his office works to keep boats honest. They approve only a limited number of scale models, do thorough inspections of the scales annually, and make sure they're calibrated daily against a known weight.
Unfortunately, none of this inherently prevents vessel owners or vessel crew from fraudulently misusing scale equipment on the boat.
Kinsolving told the council that one of the biggest loopholes in the current regulations is a provision that allows scales to be off by as much as 3% without penalty.
I take a look at those results on the boats each year when I'm out on them, and in most cases, for most boats, the majority really do try to keep those numbers as close to zero as possible. However, the truth is you do have some that seem to believe that 3% is a goal rather than a max.
With the vessels processing hundreds of tons of fish a day, Kinsolving says 3% underreporting can add up to a lot of fish that isn't being accounted for. He says if boats were required to report the results of their calibrations daily, it would be easier to spot vessels trying to game the system.
And if we do indeed have a boat that's pushing those limits to try to kind of rein them in before the full year is up.
Kinsolving also told the council that the agency wants to expand video monitoring of the fish weighing area to make it more difficult for anyone to tamper with the scale undetected.
We have video on the majority of the boats that weigh catch at sea, and extending that system so that we could keep a close eye on that critical point in our catch accounting system where all that catch is weighed, it would not be technologically difficult, and I believe that it could help significantly reduce the potential for fraud.
In testimony to the council, industry representatives mostly supported the proposed changes. Chad C., the executive director of the Freezer Longline Coalition, asked Kinsolving to tweak a proposal that would shift how vessels schedule their annual exams, but said that in general, he thought the updated regulations would be positive.
Many of those proposals are needed and within the realm of what the agency needs to do and can do to improve technology and recognize new technologies.
The changes could start being implemented as soon as January 2015. In Unalaska, I'm Stephanie Joyce.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The long-running tug-of-war over the name of North America's highest peak was back in front of the U.S. Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee today. Ranking committee member Lisa Murkowski recorded a win after Senate Bill 155, a one-page piece of legislation, passed out of committee in favor of changing the name to Denali. Senator Murkowski says she's defending the true Alaskan name for the majestic peak.
It deserves to be called the name that the Athabascans from the interior have called it for decades and decades and decades. I think it's important that we honor and tribute Alaska's first peoples by officially recognizing the big one as Denali.
True to the script of this long-running saga, Ohio Republican Senator Rob Portman voted against the change, saying he is defending Ohio, where President William McKinley was born and served as a governor in the 1800s. Portman also says the name of the national park has already been changed to Denali.
I know the Athabascans do call it Denali. There are a couple other Native peoples who call it other things. There are two other names, at least, that are the Lutus and another Native group. But the point is, we'd like to keep our Mount McKinley within the Denali National Park.
The committee approved the bill by a voice vote that clears it for consideration by the full Senate, although it's not certain that it will make it to the floor. The village of Chignik Lagoon on the Alaska Peninsula, with a year-round population of around 70, hopes to break ground this season on a small, long-awaited hydroelectric project. For a price tag of about $2.5 million, the simple system may produce as much power as the village typically needs. As KDLG's Dave Benninger reports, this is one of several alternative energy projects the Lake and Peninsula Borough has undertaken in an effort to lower costs and ease off of fossil fuels in its villages.
Chignik is an Aleut word for big wind, and several homes in Chignik Lagoon, one of the three Chignik villages, have small wind turbines that produce some electrical power. But the village, nestled between some of the peninsula's famously jagged terrain, has its eye on another way to ease away from expensive diesel-generated electricity. Lake and Peninsula Borough Manager Nathan Hill is standing near Packers Creek, which splashes quickly down the mountains before passing through town and emptying into the lagoon.
The Packers Creek Hydro Project will be a run-of-the-river project, which means we're taking water out of the river and putting it back in the river and into the creek, and it'll run a 175-kilowatt turbine.
And if that's true and holds up most of the year, it ought to meet or beat the village's electrical needs, says Michelle Anderson at the village council.
In the summer, our peak high is about 116 kilowatts. And so this installed capacity for the hydro will be 177. So we'll actually have some additional energy to be able to use for electrical heating, perhaps, and different things like that.
It's been designed to offset some 44,000 gallons of costly diesel fuel per year, as well as another 10,000 gallons of heating oil. The electric rate may come down from 75 cents per kilowatt hour to more like 20 or 22 cents, which would be paid to the village to operate and maintain the system. Packers Creek was surveyed by the Army Corps of Engineers in the early 80s, and a feasibility study was done in the mid-90s. And today, Anderson says residents are ready to see it come together.
They're ready for a lower power rate. It gets pretty high here. And to see any kind of alternative energy aside from the diesel being, having to use the diesel, I think people are excited about. So to be able to live off the land a little bit more is beneficial.
Residents do live off the land here, or rather the water, evidenced by the impressive seine fleet nearby, busy hauling in loads of sockeye, just one season of the year-round Chignik fishery. Needless to say, permitting took some time, but Hill says the Packers Creek project is fairly low impact.
You're not creating a huge dam. You're just taking water out, running a turbine, and then you're putting the water right back into the creek.
Packers is also not in an anadromous fish stream, and the intake is up a 40-foot falls. The construction's been funded by the Alaska Energy Authority, and it's out to bid with a couple of firms showing interest. For Hill, this is but one of many alternative energy projects Lake and Penn has studied or helped develop in an effort to lower energy costs in its villages.
We're dealing with wind, hydro, and biomass. We've got a couple of wood-fired boilers, one in Kakanak, one in Igiagik. We're doing wind studies in Igigik and Leavelock. There are three villages around the Iliamna Lake area that are being run off the Tizimna Hydro Project, and I think right now they're well over 90% renewable. So yeah, we're looking forward to helping communities decrease the dependency on fossil fuels.
For Packers Creek, Lake and Penn put $400,000 on the table for the permitting and design phase. As in all projects, Hill says the borough expects the village to take ownership after construction.
We help with some expertise and we help get these projects rolling, but once the project is complete, we sign it over to the village, and the village is expected to maintain the project.
Supposing construction gets underway this year, a custom turbine will take a year to a year and a half to build, meaning Chignik Lagoon may run on hydropower by late next fall. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
More than 20 kids graduated from Bethel's Alaska Youth Academy's summer camp last Friday. The idea is to encourage kids in the area to consider law enforcement careers. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Kyle Clayton reports.
The teenagers have spent the last week waking up before 6 a.m., doing physical training, and learning about the various role public safety plays in rural Alaska.
We pushed a bus half a mile or over a mile. There's
kind of easy.
That's Micah Slim describing PT. He's just finished a fire safety class and, along with the other students, will be certified to use a fire extinguisher. The end of the course also included the science behind how fires start and the nuts and bolts of snow-go maintenance. The camp's goal is twofold. Retired State Trooper Mark Oddie says one purpose is to familiarize the kids with public safety officers who often come into the villages.
Absent these camps, they may not get a chance to spend a couple of hours with a trooper or a deputy marshal unless they're taking somebody out of their home under arrest.
Alaskan State Trooper Captain Stephen Arlo says the primary focus of the camp is to introduce the youths to possible careers in public safety.
We need folks from this region to be the next generation of public safety employees. And we're having a hard time filling positions that we could fill right now because the adult population exclude themselves from getting into the career just because of their criminal history.
At this stage, it's difficult to measure the effectiveness of the program. Arlo says the project is a long-term commitment, and they won't see positions being filled anytime soon. But he's optimistic about the changes he's seen as the camp has progressed. Chantel Nakusuk attended last year's camp and came back this summer to help new students. She says the skills they learn at camp might one day allow them to save lives.
If you learn CPR here at the academy, or you may be able to turn out a fire in a house, you know, like preventing things from happening or helping someone in need.
Including this week's Youth Academy in Bethel, five others will run across Alaska this summer, including those in Mountain Village, Hooper Bay, Barrow, and Fairbanks, each one with a $70,000 price tag. The camps are being funded by multiple agencies, including the AVCP, Chelista, and TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. In Bethel, I'm Kyle Clayton.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Kyle Clayton in Bethel. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Don't wait to make your home more energy smart. Alaska Housing Finance Corporation's Home Energy Rebate Program will reimburse you for energy efficiency improvements. And if you don't have the upfront cash to make the investment, financing is available through Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Start saving money and energy today. Sign up at akrebate.com or call 877-257-3228. This message sponsored by AHFC. Across Alaska, AFS USA invites you to open your home and change the world by hosting a high school student sponsored by the U.S. State Department. There's more information online at afsusa.org or 800-AFS-INFO. This message sponsored by the U.S. State Department and AFS USA.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.